Welcome to This Week in Private Markets, a podcast by TAP. We give investors, allocators, advisors, and others a weekly digest that keeps you in the know about the news in private markets. Please see the show notes for relevant disclaimers. This is the week of August 14th, and this is what we at TAP saw in private markets. As always, we'll start with this week's big deals. Bain Capital will take Chinese data center company Chin Data private for $3.16 billion in an all-cash deal. The German software company SUSE will be taken private by EQT at a $3 billion valuation. And Bain Capital is buying the Brazilian steakhouse chain Fogo de Chão in a $1.1 billion deal. And now before we get into the main stories, I got to ask everyone, when was the last time you ate at Fogo de Chão? I can start. I'll say I ate there once. It was about a decade ago and I've never been back.
The only time I've had Brazilian barbecue is in Brazil during the Olympics. But I don't think I've ever had Fogo de Chão.
Kind of a show off. And Adam's doing a juice cleanse, so he's never been to Fogo de Chão.
Of course, I've been to Fogo de Chão many times.
Oh, nice. Really?
Yeah. There's a location, I think, right on 6th Avenue, right off 6th Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. It was quite a popular client lunch place. I don't know. Nothing gets clients to sign your engagement letters more than, I don't know, just insane amounts of grilled meat. Thank you to the good people of Fogo de Chão for all those engagements.
Yeah, well, Bain Capital is counting on your continued business. very good. All right, so let's get into the main stories this week. We start with private debt. So last week we talked about Oaktree raising its largest ever private debt fund at $18 billion. And this week we have Apollo gearing up to sign more than $4 billion in NAV loans. This time to PE firms who are basically looking to raise cash. Apparently, this includes multiple loans that are over $1 billion each. And of course, there's this background NAV financing, allows PE firms to borrow against their existing assets, gives them some liquidity, whether they want to make additional investments with that or return capital to investors. What do you guys make of this?
I think the story, I chuckled when I was reading this because, you know, obviously a couple of weeks ago you had Mark Rowan, all the coverage of Mark Rowan and his statement to Apollo and rather publicly about how Apollo was sort of revamping its image. They were not going to be sort of this feared, you know, private equity raider, but rather, you know, the nice guys on Wall Street. There's a lot of legitimate, obviously, reasons behind NAV lending, and it obviously is going to be an enormous business if you believe the projections. But I also wonder, is this a way for Apollo to kind of subjugate its weaker private equity rivals by, you know, levering them up much in the way that they lever up their portfolio companies? But, you know, we'll see. But anyway, I think, you know, 17 Capital, which I believe is backed by Oaktree, you know, they put a report out that said this, you know, NAV lending industry would grow to $100 billion over the next, you know, 7 years here. It's currently about $100 billion. So, you know, Apollo obviously wants to be at the forefront of that growth. And, you know, they are sort of expert credit investors. And, you know, similarly have this strategy of building out all sorts of business units to become a true alternative asset manager, not just a buyout shop. And, you know, they've obviously got a very successful insurance unit. You know, they have now this, you know, S3 liquidity solutions unit, of which, you know, this will probably be a big part of. I think they're just following this trend of many of these big buyout shops turning into, you know, more diversified asset management businesses. So, you know, I think it makes sense. We'll see if they play nice or if not.
Turning into the financial institutions of the United States, really. I mean, that's the crazy part about this is how they're going into every area of lending and really taking over where the banks left off, which, you know, what that means in the end, after this all plays out, is going to be increased regulation of these private markets. And obviously that's exactly what the markets are running away from, right? Is the crazy levels of regulation that have been put on the, you know, commercial banking industry. And if you get into this for a while, what we'll see is higher cost of capital. So just as an example for, you know, some of these NAV loans, with the article quotes here, and, you know, this lines up roughly with what we see in the market, is that, you know, these NAV loans typically fetch, you know, 550 to 700 basis points above prime or something similar to that. So these are pretty expensive loans more expensive than you would often get from a bank. This is the expensive cost of capital from these private institutions. And so that's what we'll get first. And then we'll, as these get larger, the cost of capital will come down, but you'll get more and more regulation. And it's kind of a game of cat and mouse away from the regulators. But I mean, in the end, we might see Apollo being the next JP Morgan. And actually, in fact, Jamie Dimon here was quoted as saying, these guys are dancing in the streets. The private credit funds are dancing in the streets because of the way that banks are having to step away from lending to these businesses. And just means shorter term, cost of capital will go up. Longer term, it'll attract regulation into private markets. But for right now, it's dancing in the streets for the private credit funds.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't really want to see any of these guys dancing at all.
You don't want to see them dancing in the street or dancing on the graves of their competitors is what it sounds like you're more worried about.
Yeah, no, I'm not worried. It makes sense, right? When there's a demand for capital, there's a demand for capital at a certain price. And
well, if you look at Jamie Dimon, I mean, Jamie Dimon is famous for going in and doing very interesting competitive things and buying out his competitors, right? I mean, he went in and he bought FRB out of right in the middle of their run. And he's done this over and over again, that in crises, he's gone and taken over the competitors. And, you know, that's how you consolidate an industry and end up being some of the biggest players out there. And maybe that's what we're already seeing from these private equity, these very large diversified private equity firms, that they're kind of setting themselves apart. And it's either it's get big or die. These guys are all getting really, really big. And probably we will not see that go away. As there's more regulation as well, you'll see the incentives to get bigger and bigger become larger as well. So this probably trend will continue for years and years.
I agree. Makes total sense.
Let's move on to another huge private markets firm then. CVC Capital Partners has rekindled its plans to go public later this year. They've had a great year of fundraising, which notably included a $28 billion buyout fund, and are looking to use that momentum to go public. As valuation context, in 2021, they were currently valued at $16 billion, and they currently have 140 billion euros of AUM. So substantial.
Yeah, I mean, this dovetails really nicely, I think, to the Apollo news we just covered. CVC, obviously, they are the biggest name in European private equity for sure. You don't see funds at this scale quite as often across the pond. So, I mean, this is big news. I mean, they are the biggest, player in private equity. But look, I think similarly, they're going public under a lot of the same, motivation that firms in the United States, went public for and why they expanded their businesses into lending and insurance and things like, NAV loans that Apollo is kicking off right now. I think CVC has similar ambitions. They obviously, perhaps will not attain the same kind of valuations they perhaps would have during, this era that everyone now is saying is over of, cheap debt and low interest rates. But they obviously want to expand into lending, insurance, secondaries. I think they bought Glendower, which is a secondaries fund, not so long ago. I think they're trying to stay competitive, as Jeff mentioned, grow or get huge or die and get consumed by your competitors like Apollo. CVC doesn't want that to happen, obviously. And
what is the benefit of going public for these firms? I mean, I was listening to a podcast with one of the guys who was early at Ares, I believe, and he was talking about really that the main benefit for them was the notoriety that they got from going public, which is such a crazy thing that, oh yeah, like go change everything about how your business operates and financially and how you incentivize people. I would have thought something like, well, we can incentivize people with really liquid equity and all this stuff. And he said, these are nice to haves. But the big thing was that all of our customers now recognized us because they saw our ticker ticking every once in a while. Is that really it? Is that the story? That's it?
I think that's half the story, at least. I mean, look, if I want to buy insurance, I kind of want to buy it from, a name I see on the New York Stock Exchange that I see on all the billboards. I don't see advertisements for CVC, right? I mean, it's just not what private equity funds do. But all of a sudden, when you do get that public notoriety, I do think there are, notable benefits, notable sales benefits to your other business units. I don't necessarily think it helps you, take the next big company private or Win the next auction for a private company. But it'll certainly help, businesses like insurance to have that notoriety for sure.
I wonder if so many businesses stay private then, right? I mean, like, because the downsides of going public are big as well, right? I mean, you have this sort of different level of scrutiny that you're under from a regulatory perspective, but mostly from an investor perspective. And unless you see notable benefits, like if you're in certain businesses where does it really matter in some businesses, if you're public, like probably not so much, but in other ones, obviously, it can be important. And so obviously trade-off, but if that's the only benefit, I mean, man, stay private for a lot of companies.
If I wanted to juice my public awareness, I'd probably just go public for a few years, get that public awareness, and then take myself private again and not deal with the hassle. But I mean, the other thing, Jeff, though, I mean, look, this could make a lot of people, filthy rich, at CVC. Not that they're, begging, for money. I mean, at least not, from their LPs always, of course. But, when Evercore went public or when Moelis went public, my former employers, I mean, those partners made a killing, right? I mean, they were multi-millionaires that converted into, nine-figure millionaires, many of them. So it's really
funny money before, the private markets, right? The shares are funny money. It's like, okay, yeah, I guess it's worth X million, right? But then when you go public, it's liquid and you know what it's worth. So, I mean, look, I get that. The crazy thing for me was the idea that really the marketing seemed to be internally the most perceptible benefit. The most obvious benefit for them was the marketing aspect of it to show that you're established.
Good stuff. We move on. MSCI is set to acquire the remaining stake in Burgiss for almost $700 million in cash. And Burgiss is, of course, a provider of data and analytics solutions for investors. Their data set is quite vast. They have data on over 13,000 private funds in I think, almost 200 countries. And that represents about $15 trillion in cumulative investments. And I also want to say they've been around for 30 years. So as far as I'm concerned, some of the data might still be carved into stone tablets or something. It predates the internet pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting to see sort of the stalwart in public markets fintech coming in and saying that privates are so important that they're going to spend $1 billion, which they said was overpaying. I think it was 12 times revenue, which is overpaying, I guess, for Burgiss. But, I think MSCI sits around there in terms of their own stock. They had already purchased a majority minority stake before, and this was actually just finishing off the strategic investment and turning it into a full-on subsidiary of MSCI. And they have big plans for what they're going to be able to do in getting into private markets. They see the growth in private markets been huge, and they see that it could be a really important part of their business going forward, a growing part of their business, right? I mean, inside of MSCI's business, this is an index company. So really where they make all their money is off of creating, data and creating indices for public markets. And, some of the big expansion areas recently have been ESG and things like that, but they always want to tack on a new expansion area. And obviously private markets are an example of that. They're purchasing one of the marquee names in private market, the marquee data sets, like you said, 13,000 funds and 100,000 plus underlying companies that they have some sort of data on. So there's already indices here that Burgiss publishes and a lot of data that they publish, but MSCI probably can take to the next level and hopefully is a big part of taking privates to the next level.
Well, let me ask, what do you think they're paying for here? It's just the data set worth $700 million incremental dollars?
Yes. Well, I mean, that's the seat of the table, right? Do you know how they get that data? Burgiss does an amazing job of servicing their clients in terms of they have a portfolio management system that makes it easy to organize all this data. And as an ancillary benefit, they get access to all the data. MSCI, it's just hugely valuable. Where else are you going to get that data where you have it at the core and you're allowed to make indices of it and all that stuff? I mean, it is very valuable, and MSCI sees value there. I think it's a strategic thing because of how big private markets are getting. So yeah, I think that is what they claimed, right? I mean, obviously the business has good value of its own. I mean, it is throwing off $90 million in EBITDA a year, growing at 20%. So, it's a great business. The reason to pay a little more for it was for strategic reasons that MSCI obviously thinks they can take the cash flows and take that data and turn it into even more cash.
Yeah, I mean, it's a clever bet. I think it makes sense. If you know, I mean, we at TAB, obviously, you know, we know how much of a pain acquiring this private data is, right? And aggregating and normalizing it. And if you can buy it, I mean, great. And you know, it's also a bet on the secular trend of, you know, growth of private investing and private assets, you know, a bet we've made at TAP as well. And you know, I think a bet that many people agree with. So yeah, I mean, look, I think it's clever and, you know, it's sort of now, particularly, I mean, all of these stories around the difficulty around fundraising and, you know, LPs being, you know, scrutinizing managers more and more. I mean, I think data will only become more and more important. You know, as LPs, you know, scrutinize, you know, their managers, their investments increasingly. And I think if you kind of marry, you know, this public markets expert of creating indices and making data available to public investors, and, you know, you marry that with, you know, Burgess, a leader in private data, and you can make private investing, you know, much more transparent, you know, combining their two capabilities, then, you know, I think it makes complete sense. This is a good buy for them, you know, sort of regardless of price in the future here.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, BlackRock has, what was it, eFront, Burgess being acquired. Everyone seems to be kind of taking the main data sources private here for the data aggregators. So I'm very curious to see how the space evolves. One small note, Burgess has 90 million in annual revenue, not quite 90 million in EBITDA. So not quite that juicy.
Good correction there. That would be nice though, wouldn't it?
Okay. Let's move on to the next story here. The SEC has set a late August date for new transparency rules for the private fund industry. As a bit of background here, in early 2022, the SEC proposed a set of changes for private fund advisors that would require them to produce quarterly statements on performance, fees, submit annual audits, stuff like that. They also put in place, or proposed, I should say, some new rules around charging fees for services that were never rendered. So those are some things that were in the proposal. Now we'll need to see kind of how that shapes up and what comes back in the final version of the proposal when it's released in the coming weeks. How are you guys feeling about this?
Yeah, I saw your lips start to move, Jeff, but I guess I've already started talking. I love all the statistics around the size of you know, private assets. I mean, the SEC says it's a $20 trillion industry. Burgess has $15 trillion, you know, in and of itself. I mean, I don't know how big is private funds. I can't seem to find a reliable sort of metric.
I mean, Gensler here was saying that they earn hundreds of billions of dollars in fees, which I can believe that at the very least. And I mean, it does seem like the SEC has taken a very keen interest in privates. This is some of the biggest regulation that's come out on privates in a long while. And they're doing it pretty quickly here. So the kind of the news this week is really that they are going to vote on this in late August. And it's going to have perhaps roughly a year long implementation time is one of the timelines that's been bandied about. So that's pretty quick. And they're kind of getting it done a little bit unilaterally. You know, Gensler has a 3-2 majority vote on the committee that's voting on this. And so, yeah, I mean, it looks like it's going to pass for sure. And now it's just a question of all the lobbying that was done over the past year or so. How has that played out? And how are we actually going to see the final rule come out? You know, some of the things at stake, and I think we'll cover this again when it actually comes out and gets voted on and probably does pass. But some of the things at stake here are rules affecting RIAs and ERAs, which a lot of folks in venture or small funds fall under. And some of the biggest ones that people have been talking about are side letters. And so side letters allow investors to receive different terms, usually different fee terms, but a variety of different terms when they invest into a fund. And so usually this will be used to give larger checks into a fund, a lower fee. They are not allowing side letters as part of this regulation. That's one of the big things here. And so all these sort of side deals are either going to get cleaned out or perhaps grandfathered in. I mean, you could see a big reckoning coming if they force them to standardize all these things, even backdating it, right? But most, I think that my personal opinion is that these things, this is the side letter thing, for instance, is not really an important development because they've already had most favored nations. clauses in most of these side letters, which means that most people don't really get better terms than the rest of the than the investors, or at least the other ones who have MFNs in their side letters. So that's an example, and I think it's kind of the whole thing's real with it of them really just, I guess, putting into regulation what's already in practice, which I don't think is as big of a deal for on the downside. It's also not as big of a deal on the upside. So for instance, another example of this is where, requiring that they publish quarterly audited statements, which is pretty much the standard in all these large funds anyways. So these are a couple examples of things that folks are already doing that the SEC is sort of mandating that they do, and they're saying, oh, we don't want to do it. Now, some of the stuff that they are putting on the table that isn't normal, one of the big ones is that they're allowing investors to sue for negligence. And I don't know, Adam, you're the attorney or former attorney or whatever here, but I don't know exactly what this means, but it definitely opens up the Jeep general partners of these funds to, being sued by their investors with a much lower bar than they have historically been able to sue them by. So those are some of the changes that we'll see how they actually, pan out when we get this final ruling later this month.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is about, manager exposure. And, I think that's exactly right. The bar for negligence, I mean, it's kind of whatever, the jury thinks, was negligent, I guess, at the time. It's hard to know, right? What would the reasonable person think is negligent or not? Is the actual standard, right? And that can mean so many things. But I know one thing. I mean, this is going to be litigated like crazy. I mean, this is a future Supreme Court case, without a doubt. Assuming the rules come out in a way that is seen as adverse to the GPs. I mean, even the industry is already pushing back on this. Relying on Supreme Court precedent, which I think there was a case last year that curtailed government agencies' abilities to regulate climate in certain contexts. And yeah, I mean, this is clearly a Supreme Court case around the power of federal agencies, to regulate without a specific bill pushed through Congress or something like that. So I think lawyers are certainly gearing up for this. Lobbyists are have been doing work obviously for the last year or so. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, how obviously the Supreme Court politically is very different from the SEC politically. We'll probably have very, very different views. On how
we don't know who will be president, right? I mean, in a little while, right? So, I mean, that's the other thing I was seeing. Someone was saying, "Oh, we're gonna sue and then hunker down and see who ends up being president." So, I mean, things change on this, but for the most part, it seems like right now it's moving pretty fast. They are gonna sign this thing, the final rule, towards the end of the month, and then there'll be a pretty fast implementation time on it. So, I mean,
there will be a circuit split. Without a doubt, more conservative leaning courts and more liberal leaning courts obviously will have very different views on this. And, that has the makings of the Supreme Court taking this up. So anyway, as a former legal nerd, I'm pretty excited to see what happens here.
Well, it's interesting that you quote that it's that Gary, they called it a $20 trillion industry that which they make it seem larger than everyone else. I've heard places that quoted a 9, 12, 14. SEC's got it pegged at 20. And so unless there's something I don't know, I mean, I think really what it is they might be including hedge funds in there. That's one of the big things potentially. But really, I mean, they just want to make it seem as large as possible because, if it is $20 trillion, you sure as heck better regulate it. If they are making hundreds of billions of dollars in fees, maybe some of that is a little bit too much in his view. So that, I guess that's probably why they want to make it seem larger than everyone else.
Very good. Let's move on to our last story for today. Private equity firms are pushing into Formula One, in particular the private equity firms Redbird Capital and Otro Capital joined forces to buy a minority stake in the F1 team Alpine Racing. Best of all, they're joining Ryan Reynolds as a part owner here.
Well, I like that they're joining Rob McElhenney.
I have to correct you as a Formula One nerd. But anyway, sorry, Jeff, to interrupt.
Oh, Alpine, I'm terribly sorry. Yes, good catch.
They got Rob McElhenney on here and Michael B. Jordan on here as well. So obviously a lot of star power in the room. And I think this article, one of the articles here that we're reading, if anyone who's a Always Sunny in Philadelphia fan, it should be called The Gang Buys a Formula One Team, because Robert McElhenney is the creator of Always Sunny in Philadelphia. But you know, this is the second thing that him and Ryan Reynolds have bought together. They bought that soccer team that they had a Netflix series about, and you know, Ryan Reynolds is also famous for he bought Mint Mobile.
Yeah, Ryan Reynolds is a PE firm at this point, I'm pretty sure.
It's crazy. I mean, you know, watch out, Kim Kardashian. You know, Ryan Reynolds is out there and he's making deals. So, I mean, I think Ryan Reynolds is going to be one of the richest celebrities on earth after doing all this, right? And it just shows that getting equity. I mean, Chamath was talking about a few weeks ago on the All In podcast. He was talking about how, you know, sports teams should really give the players equity because they will make more money than they'd ever make from cash in that way. And this is an example of, you know, some of these celebrities being able to get equity and really drive a lot of value, probably.
Yeah, I mean, Ryan Reynolds, the best sports investor to leverage, you know, Netflix crazes around teams or around new sports. You know, I mean, this, you know, when I think when Bernie Eccleston had sold this to, I think it was Liberty Media, right, had bought Formula One. I mean, that must be one of the best trades in history for Liberty Media. And, you know, Netflix was, you know, instrumental in that, obviously. Look, I mean, I don't know. Many sports investments end up turning into a complete disaster. You know, you see this in European soccer, you know, after a decade of all of the money flowing into Man City, you know, I think they were finally able to win, you know, a Champions League. But other than that, it's been in fact the kind of locally owned, you know, historical teams that keep winning, you know, the Champions League, you know, titles as well. So, you know, we'll see if money makes the same difference or a different, you know, amount of difference in Formula One. But at least this is a sport where, you know, you can certainly translate, you know, dollars into R&D, into better engines, into a better car. But, you know, for some reason, you know, Mercedes, Red Bull and Ferrari, you know, historically continue to kind of lead here. And, you know, perhaps it's money, perhaps it's reputation, but I have a sense it's also human capital wanting to go to the best brands. So I'm not totally convinced, you know, more money here is exactly what we'll build this team. But, you know, we'll see. And again, I think, you know, as you allude to, Jeff, there's just, you know, broad interest among, you know, private investors in sports because of, you know, this power of the brand. And that has, you know, kind of exponential impact on your returns here, from, you know, for doing almost nothing, you know, seemingly. Cool. You don't necessarily need to win more titles to get.
You can put a bunch of star power onto a team and you can end up, you know, actually making money, even if the team doesn't become a winning team in any way, shape or form, because in the end, sports are entertainment. And I think there's kind of different ways to view sports. And some people view it as this really serious thing where it's competition. It's all about winning and everything. Other folks view it as entertainment. And I think the elite level folks view it as both, you know, and in this case, if you can do one or the other, you're probably going to end up having a good investment.
Very good stuff. Very good stuff. Yeah, I look forward to seeing Ryan Reynolds bring his star power to bear here and bring some great human capital into Formula One. And maybe we'll see, as a result, some of the leaders of private equity firms get more into influencing. I feel like that's the main takeaway. Anyway, with that, we'll wrap up this week in private markets. And from the gang at TAP, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.